Lewandowski was helping to cover up sexual assaults in the recruiting and retention battalion.
An Alaska National Guard Lieutenant Colonel was recommended for discharge, but remained in a leadership role. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, October 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the University of Alaska Southeast opens up a dialogue on sexual assault.
I think that what our students think about how we're doing, how we could do better, will only be to our benefit.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
Everett Simone of Shagaluk was arraigned on murder charges at the Bethel court this afternoon. He is accused of the brutal killing of his parents in the village of Shagaluk earlier this week. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Appearing via video teleconference from the Yukon Kuskokwim Correctional Center, Everett Simone stared through the TV monitor into the small Bethel courtroom, uttering little more than yes or no to questions asked by the judge. Judge Nathaniel Peters read the charges to the 21-year-old, who said he understood them. Then he set bail.
The court will follow the state's recommendation, impose bail of $500,000 cash plus third-party custodian. If you have a bail hearing, the court can set further conditions of your release. Mr. Simone, any questions? Any questions? No? Okay.
Simone was arrested Wednesday at approximately 4 p.m. and brought to the Bethel jail after two people were killed in Shagaluk Tuesday. Earlier today, Alaska State Troopers identified them as residents Flossie Simone, 46, and John Arrow, 57. A trooper spokesperson says people in Shagaluk have said the two are the suspect's parents. The remains of both are being transported to the state medical examiner's office in Anchorage for autopsies. Residents reportedly caught the suspect themselves and held him until troopers arrived the next day. Troopers were requested on Tuesday evening but didn't arrive to Shagaluk until mid-morning Wednesday. Shagaluk is a village of 83 people located on the Innoko River, 20 miles east of Anvik and 150 miles northeast of Bethel. The village has no police or medical personnel presence. The Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation has sent a crisis response team to Shagaluk to help residents with counseling. Simone is charged with two counts of murder one. His next court appearance is a preliminary hearing October 20th in Aniak. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A lieutenant colonel in the Alaska National Guard was recommended for an other than honorable discharge earlier this year, according to a story in this week's Anchorage Press. Joseph Lewandowski is the Guard's deputy chief of staff for operations and training. Reporter David Holthouse says he started looking into Lewandowski after reading the National Guard Bureau's Office of Complex Investigations report that came out last month.
I started taking a pretty hard look at Lewandowski and started working some sources and was able to come up with a AR-15-6 report, which is a reference to the Army regulation for investigations of officers, which was basically an internal investigation conducted within the Alaska National Guard into the conduct of specifically Lieutenant Colonel Lewandowski. And that report, which was submitted on March 3rd of this year to the top-ranking officers of the Alaska National Guard, found that Lewandowski was helping to cover up sexual assaults in the recruiting and retention battalion by allowing NCOs, non-commissioned officers under his command, to intimidate fellow soldiers who came forward with allegations of sexual assault. And that he was fostering a command climate that, an exact quote from the report is, empowered those NCOs to commit sexual assault and sexual harassment against fellow soldiers, recruits, and civilian women.
I would imagine that this is why he was recommended for other than honorable discharge earlier this year, but explain how that process kind of came about.
Well, the AR-15-6 report was basically contained a recommendation from the investigators to the top commanders of the Alaska National Guard that Lewandowski receive an other than honorable discharge. What happened to that recommendation is unclear, but it was not followed. Lewandowski is still in the National Guard.
What other details are included in the AR-15-6 report?
The report finds Lieutenant Colonel Lewandowski personally in violation of several codes of conduct of the National Guard, including instances where he allowed guard vehicles to be used for outings to strip clubs. References an occasion where he was intoxicated in public at the after party for the Iron Dog snow machine race in 2012. Lewandowski arranged for the National Guard to be the top sponsor of the Iron Dog race starting in 2010. It references his exchanging some 10,000 text messages with a female employee of Iron Dog while he was negotiating the sponsorship terms. And it references his condoning steroid use by non-commissioned officers under his command in the Recruitment and Retention Battalion.
David Lewandowski was, there's information about him being involved in the pornography industry. What's known about that?
Well, state records show that in 1999, Lieutenant Colonel Lewandowski, who at the time was a civilian, formed a company called Kodiak Entertainment, which owned and operated more than half a dozen online pornography sites over the course of the next 4 years. Lewandowski dissolved the corporation in 2003 when he joined the Alaska National Guard. I included that information in the story because while I'm a fierce advocate of free speech, I think that the fact that he was involved in the pornography business for 4 years immediately prior to joining the Alaska National Guard, again, has a direct bearing on the way in which women were allegedly treated in his command.
David, your article doesn't include any response from Lieutenant Colonel Lewandowski. Did you try to reach out to him?
Yeah. I sent letters to Lieutenant Colonel Lewandowski's addresses that I was able to find through public records. I also contacted the National Guard to see if he would be made available for an interview and was essentially told that they would not discuss Lieutenant Colonel Lewandowski as they would not discuss any named individual who is part of any ongoing investigation or administrative action.
Reporter David Holthaus wrote the story on Lieutenant Colonel Lewandowski for this week's Anchorage Press. The Alaska Energy Authority has responded to letters from the National Marine Fisheries Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that questioned research being done on the Susitna-Watana Hydroelectric Project. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
Of the two federal agencies, the National Marine Fisheries Service took a stronger position regarding AEA's ability to produce accurate models of salmon activity in the Susitna River. The NMFS letter cited 14 areas of concern, including sampling methods and possible misidentification of juvenile fish. The agency says that the problems are significant enough that no further studies should be done until they're resolved. On Wednesday, AEA labeled the criticism as inaccurate. In a news release, Susitna-Watana project manager Wayne Dyock says the NMFS letter, quote, relies on mischaracterizations and generalizations. The actual response letter by AEA, which is signed by Dyock, goes even further, saying that assertions made by the Fisheries Service are untenable, bordering on the absurd. AEA's response letter to the National Marine Fisheries Service totals nearly 50 pages. Most of that is a line-by-line refutation of the concerns listed by NMFS. Many of AEA's specific responses assert that NMFS is either ignoring the data or misunderstands the methodologies being used. The Alaska Energy Authority maintains that it is following the study plan approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. FERC will have the opportunity to hear out both sides soon. Meetings are scheduled to start next week to discuss the Susitna-Watana fieldwork. Part of the objective of those meetings is for FERC to decide what, if any, changes need to be made in future field studies. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, determining the best way to manage future king salmon on the Kuskokwim.
What we've heard is that when we have restrictions in river, we want other users to be contributing to the future of Chinook salmon as well.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
KSKA DJ Marvell Johnson was killed this week by his foster son, but state officials with the foster care system stress that events like this are extremely rare, and they have systems in place to keep foster parents and children safe. Director of Juvenile Justice Karen Forrest says they work with both families and young people before placing a child in a home.
They get an opportunity to review the entire file of the youth, and they also spend time with the youth and interview that young person. And so there's lots of discussion to determine whether or not it's a good match.
Christy Lawton is the director of the Office of Children's Services. She says foster parents are trained to work with young people who have experienced trauma and may act out. She says OCS provides a support network, including court-appointed advocates. Lawton says the benefits of being a foster parent far outweigh the risks.
You're taking in, you know, often very vulnerable children and youth who've been through indescribable pain and trauma in many cases. So to be able to be a good shepherd to them and to mentor and to provide the kind of structure and nurturance that they may have never experienced before, I can't think of anything more rewarding than to be able to fill that role.
Marvell Johnson was a foster parent for more than 15 years and helped hundreds of youth. Lawton says they are reaching out to the foster care community to help them through this loss. The agencies say only two other incidents of violence against foster parents have been reported in the last two decades. There are about 2,200 kids in foster care in Alaska. Students at the University of Alaska Southeast will get a chance to talk to federal auditors about sexual assault on campus. The Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights will be at the UAS Juneau campus tomorrow as part of an examination of the university's handling of complaints and reports of sexual harassment and violence. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
University of Alaska Southeast Chancellor John Pugh emailed letters to faculty, staff, and students at the end of September, informing them of the Office of Civil Rights visit and inviting them to participate. Posters have been placed around campus, encouraging students to speak out for campus safety. Lori Klein is a student conduct administrator at UAS. She's been helping OCR organize the meetings and says members of the Juneau community and campus are invited to two open office sessions.
People can just drop in and talk to them about campus safety in general or specific circumstances that they've been involved in that they'd like to share with OCR.
In May, the University of Alaska system was added to a list of colleges around the country being investigated by the Department of Education for mishandling sexual assault complaints or as part of a compliance review. A team from OCR in Seattle will meet with UAS staff in the morning. Two focus groups will be held in the afternoon, one for female students and another for male students. Klein says student involvement is voluntary. OCR wants to hear from Alaska Native students, campus activists, international students, and survivors of sexual assault.
We did not send a specific invite to students who had disclosed that they were survivors, and that was per OCR's guidance. So instead, what we did is specifically targeted lots of other groups of students that may include survivors, but all students are invited.
Since the investigation began in May, the University of Alaska has submitted more than 10,000 pages of documentation, including details of each sexual assault complaint since 2011. Klein says after the initial trepidation of being investigated, she's come to value the involvement of OCR.
oftentimes when you get someone from an outside organization coming in and asking really great and targeted questions, you get information from your student population that you might not get otherwise. And I think that what our students think about how we're doing, how we could do better, will only be to our benefit.
After the campus visits, Klein says the Office of Civil Rights will prepare a findings report listing recommendations or requirements for change. OCR has already visited University of Alaska Anchorage and University of Alaska Fairbanks. The auditors are also visiting UAF's Kuskokwim campus in Bethel. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
With less than a month until Election Day, the race to become Alaska's next governor is heating up. Independent candidate Bill Walker and his Democrat running mate are canvassing the state for votes all the way out to the Aleutians. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
It might be a big port community, but it's not unusual for political campaigns to skip on Alaska. The town is hard to get to, and there aren't a lot of voters on the other side. Then again, most candidates don't have a retired Unalaska city servant running their campaign.
Thank you, Bill, for coming to my town. This is just so awesome.
That's Unalaska's old director of public works, Nancy Peterson. She brought Walker to the Norwegian Rat Saloon on Friday night. About 40 residents munched on hot dogs and homemade chips as they fired off questions at the candidate. Walker came prepared to talk about his vision for a bipartisan administration, but some voters, like Noli Magpantai, were more curious about Walker's background.
So yeah, Republican, Democrat, or?
I'm an Alaskan. I run as independent.
Independent?
Yeah.
Okay.
Walker explained that he jumped parties to run for governor after years as a Republican. Unalaskans usually lean Democrat, but Magpantai said that's not written in stone.
Well, we support Lisa last time, and she's right in when she was right in.
Right, uh-huh.
That's Lisa Murkowski, and the write-in was her 2010 campaign for Senate as a Republican.
You know, I was a Democrat, but whatever we need
right,
in this
exactly.
Alaska, you know, I mean, yeah,
yep.
Exactly.
Yep.
So
yep.
We got together here and that's what we did. And
yeah.
She won.
Good.
That's what Walker and Malott are banking on. Their campaign promises to put Alaska first on projects like a natural gas pipeline. At the bar and in an interview this weekend, Walker said he wants to tweak the current structure so the state owns the biggest share of a pipeline. He believes that would get gas flowing faster to rural communities.
Any place that's connected with a road, a river, an ocean in Alaska should be able to have access to our natural resources. There's various forms of renewable energy that would be very effective. I mean, we're not necessarily, you know, just one commodity fits all. But any place we can get liquefied natural gas to at a very, very low cost, I'm all about that.
High energy costs are a persistent problem in the Aleutians, but the region's also wrapped up in thorny policy issues, like whether to build a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge.
If there's a genuine issue to have a road for medical and medevacs, for health and safety reasons, I'll work aggressively to make sure that there's a road built.
Governor Sean Parnell's administration has recently turned to the courts, but Walker's not sure if he would continue with the two lawsuits they have in process.
The slowest way to do something is through litigation. I mean, I own a law firm. I'm familiar with how the wheels of justice move pretty darn slowly. And when you're taking on the largest law firm in the nation, which is the federal government, that doesn't always expedite the process. No, I there's other ways of addressing that.
Like talking to stakeholders and negotiating directly with the federal government. He says he'd take a similar approach to dealing with poor salmon runs on the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. Some tribes and subsistence fishermen are trying to get regulators to crack down on bycatch and the commercial pollock harvest. That fishery is a huge source of revenue for the state and for Unalaska. Walker says he doesn't know enough about the issue yet to take a position.
I've learned the hard way over the years is if I don't know the answer to something, I don't try to guess at something. I know there's a problem, and I'll certainly be part of finding the root cause of the problem.
Walker's sure to hear more about salmon on his next campaign stop in Bethel. After that, he'll continue touring the state, asking far-flung voters for their support on November 4th. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community.
Wells Fargo. Together, we'll go far. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
A controversial British Columbia mine northeast of Ketchikan has gained some key permits needed for construction. But the KSM project still needs other government approvals and large investments before mining can begin. A company with nearby claims says it must also grant approval. KSM spokesman Brent Murphy says the new permits allow construction of two roads from a central BC highway to the mine complex about 20 miles from the Alaska border.
Right now we're relying on helicopters, which are a very expensive way to access a project. So these are significant for us because it will allow us to start building an alternative means of accessing the project.
Road construction is expected to cost more than $200 million. Murphy says work could begin in about a year if remaining permits are approved. But first, mine owner Seabridge Gold must find investors for the $5.3 billion project.
That construction could start should we have a partner in hand, and we remain hopeful that we will have a joint venture agreement in the very near future.
The permits granted in late September cover air and water discharges from the project's construction camps. Tribal Coal Management and Chinook Bycatch took center stage Tuesday at a subsistence panel at the Association of Village Council Presidents Conference. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Reflecting on a tense and important 2014 season, Cora Campbell, the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, thanked the pack room of YK Delta fishermen for their sacrifices.
And so I want to start by complimenting you on the leadership and the conservation ethic that people showed this season in understanding that those salmon needed to pass to the spawning grounds. Thank you for conserving Chinook salmon.
Federal managers actually controlled the Chinook fishery early in the summer. And if tribal leaders build on momentum to create tribal fish commissions, there could soon be new management players. Sky Starkey is a longtime attorney for AVCP and presented an aggressive timeline for bringing in new voices.
The overriding hope is that the commissions and the tribes will meet together sometime early in the spring and will develop among themselves their ideas about how they want the rivers managed for the next year. That those tribal management plans for Chinook salmon will go to the department and to the Fish and Wildlife Service to be part of what happens for the fishing for next year.
There are still many unresolved questions related to legal issues and funding the commission. Starkey says one idea is to institute heavy fines on pollock boats that catch king salmon in their nets and use those funds for the commission. Bycatch was never far from the panelists' remarks. Commissioner Campbell touted the state's efforts to push the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's current study into possible steep reductions to Chinook bycatch limits.
What we have heard is we want the burden of conservation to be shared amongst all users. What we've heard is that when we have restrictions in river, we want other users to be contributing to the future of Chinook salmon as well.
Victor Joseph, the CEO of the Tanana Chiefs Conference, reminded the convention that the health of the fishery depends on the support from all users.
We need to know what's happening from a holistic viewpoint with this fish and with our fisheries. As I'm looking at it, whether it's the federal government, state, and the tribes at the table, and all other concerned parties, we need to find balance.
Gene Peltola Jr. from the Federal Office of Subsistence Management also spoke during the session. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Fairbanks area environmental activists say they're building on the momentum they generated 2 weeks ago during the local observance of the Global People's Climate March. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, they're forming a local chapter of the national organization to help reduce the impact of climate change.
Andrew McDonald says there's a reason that he and about 75 others turned out for the September 21st People's Climate March here in Fairbanks, along with hundreds of thousands of others worldwide, and that is Alaska is among the places that is being most affected by climate change.
It's very important to have one up here in Alaska because we're very exposed to the problem of climate change and the dangers that it is imposing on us.
Another marcher, Kristen Tim, says despite the fact that Alaska's economy is based on the extraction of oil, the state's future economic health depends on diversifying away from dependence on such climate-changing fossil fuels.
As an Alaskan and somebody who wants to stay in Alaska, you know, I really want to see Alaska prosper. I want to see our economy be vibrant. I want to see our livelihood be protected from the changes that climate change will give us here in Alaska.
Tim says even though Fairbanks is far away from the huge marches that were held around the world, she linked up with others by live tweeting the local observance.
I can only hope that people from other marches around the world were, you know, seeing what we were doing in Fairbanks and realizing that, you know, even our, you know, relatively small community has something to say and contribute to this bigger discussion.
McDonald says he and Tim and the other local organizers are determined to keep that discussion going and then to follow those words with action.
Being out there and waving our signs here in Fairbanks, it's good, but it doesn't really solve the problem. And so that's why we're looking into other solutions and really making a sustained effort to address the climate change problem.
McDonald says that sustained effort will take many forms, but it'll be based on grassroots organizing and action. And it'll begin with the formation of a local chapter of the Citizens Climate Lobby, which will be the third in the state and among more than 150 worldwide. Tim says the chapters will lobby lawmakers in their states to enact legislation to establish a revenue-neutral carbon tax, one that won't end up costing consumers more, but that will help move the United States away from dependence on fossil fuels. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ben Matheson in Bethel, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Lisa Fu and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.